Hey, what's up? Welcome to another episode of All Over VoiceOver with Kif VH. I'm your host, Kif VH, and I'm thrilled to be here in studio at Juice Studios in Santa Monica with a truly legendary voice performer. And I'll let him tell you the story more than me trying to stammer through an explanation. Please welcome the lovely, the talented Neil Ross.
I don't know about the lovely part, and I don't know about the talented part either, come to think of it. But thank you, Kif. It's good to be here.
I'm telling you, I've been aware of your work and the shows that you've been a part of, and you've really been able to. It's a fascinating career to be able to hit so many different sort of places within the voiceover world.
I was very lucky. I was thinking about it. Some people tend to get shunted into promos or trailers or only cartoons.
Yeah.
And somehow I've been lucky enough to do damn nearly everything you can do in the area of voiceovers, except maybe announcements at the Greyhound Bus Depot. But I'm ready.
Still time. Yeah, that's right. As long as their PA is working and they're not switching to a celebrity.
Yeah, that's right. We're sorry, Neil, but...
I'm sorry. Harrison Ford has that locked up.
Harrison Ford wants to come down here and announce that bus 19 is now leaving for Brawley.
Well, you've written a really terrific book called Vocal Recall, and I'm wondering if... We'll hit all that stuff, but how do we... And I know all this stuff is chronicled in the book, but just from a Cliff Notes standpoint.
Sure. Or a Kif Notes.
Yeah, Kif Notes. That's love it.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's great. I'm gonna steal that.
That was beneath both of us. But anyway, I'm the one that said it, so.
You were born in London, right?
Yes, I had no control over that. Mm. Yes. At the very tail end of World War II.
Oh, wow.
And the V2 rockets were still falling from the sky into London while I was in the womb and during the first year of my life.
Oh,
I have no memory of any of this, but I got to London a couple of years ago and I went to the British War Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wandering around and I suddenly see a sign. It says, V1 rocket from Germany and an arrow. And I realize this thing is... above me.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, there the son of a bitch is, which reminds me, what's your policy on cursing?
Son of a bitch is about as salty as I get.
Okay, I will rein it in. I apologize.
No, that's fine.
There was that thing that was trying to get me. So that's what they look like. Wow. You know,
that's something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after your family emigrates to the United States?
Yeah, the war ended. My father, who was actually a Canadian who got trapped in England by the war, decided that there wasn't much future in post-war England because the place was just decimated.
Yeah.
So he got us on a boat and we went to Canada initially. And I was in mostly Montreal for about 10 years. And then my father paid a fateful visit to some relatives of his in Los Angeles and returned with tales of this wondrous land of milk and honey, where one could swim in the Pacific Ocean in the morning and be up in the mountains skiing by the afternoons. I don't know how many people have ever
done that.
I don't
know. I haven't tried it.
Never did, but that was his...
The most I've done is picked apples in Oak Glen and then walked along the beach. But
that
ain't bad. But, I don't need to...
So off we were to California, and I arrived at the age of 12 at Franklin Junior High in Long Beach.
Oh, down in Long Beach.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you get interested in broadcasting, but like, who caught your attention? Was it radio initially, or how did it?
Well, we didn't get a television set until I was about 12 years old, so it was mostly radio and the little collection of records that I had with my record player. Did a lot of radio listening, but I did not like the music of the 50s. I just found it vapid and boring. I didn't like music at all. I would tune around listening to hear voices.
Yeah.
Even if I couldn't understand what they were talking about, it was more entertaining than the music. And then I began to... It was like a compulsion. I began to try to imitate some of the voices that I was hearing, the accents, the textures, the this, the that. It's a thing that you, You know, people say, can you teach me how to do character voices? And I say, I honestly don't know. Have you ever tried to do any just spontaneously? Oh, no. I would say I have a feeling this is not going to work. Hmm. People who are destined to do this find themselves in their room at the age of 8 trying to sound like Donald Duck. You know, other kids build model planes. You're in there trying to do Donald Duck.
That's right.
And that's how you sort of find out you're destined to perhaps do this. And you do it without any thought of, oh, this could lead to a lucrative career. You just do it because it's fun.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Of how, what's, as you're discovering, it's like an athlete wants to see how fast they can run.
Yes. Yeah.
It's about how wide is my scope. I remember thinking if I could do Rich Little, I could do everybody Rich Little could do.
Well, that's not too far off the mark.
Yeah.
Because a lot of his stuff, you only knew who he was doing by the context. Oh, that must be John Wayne. Because he said, let's take him to Missouri. Otherwise, right. I didn't have a clue.
That's right.
No offense, Rich, if you're listening.
That's hilarious. That's true. It's not a great impression if you have to say, okay, so here's my impression of this.
Yeah,
and then they go, oh, I can hear it now. Yeah.
But I had such a kick. I was listening to Dana Carvey on Howard Stern, and he was talking about how he first discovered that he could do voices. And I forget how old he was, 8, 9 years old, and the Beatles came on television.
Uh-huh. And suddenly he's walking around the house. He's doing Paul McCartney.
And, you know, his brothers have fallen on the floor. And he said, it's fun.
Yeah.
And he has this marvelous bit that he does where it's Paul talking to John in heaven and explaining to him what's going on earth. And he says, I do this around the house, not when my wife's home, obviously.
Yeah, right.
When I'm alone, it's just so much fun.
Yeah.
You know? And.
Yeah.
And I think that's how most of us end up in this business. It's like, oh my God, they'll pay me to have fun?
Yeah.
This is...
It's so...
There ought to be a law.
There really ought to be. I'm glad there isn't. They haven't quite figured out how to stop it.
We got off the track.
Yes,
so
we did.
Radio,
that's all right.
Radio. So then, one fateful afternoon, I'm in the kitchen of a friend. His sister turns the radio on, and this song comes on. And for the first time in my life, I'm hearing music I enjoy, and it's beyond enjoyment. It starts at the tip of my toes and explodes out of the top of my head. I am experiencing joy, euphoria. I don't know what the hell's happening to me. And that was a record called Tutti Frutti by Little Richard. And I remember midway through the song in my little... however old I was, 10-year-old brain, I'm saying, somebody finally got it right. Mm. I've been waiting my whole life to hear this.
Yeah.
And that began a romance with rock and roll, and the only way to get it in those days was you had to listen to the radio and find a station that played this.
Yeah.
And so I became a huge music radio listener if it was a top 40 or rock and roll format.
Sure.
And like everybody who got seduced by blues or rock and roll, you want to be a part of it somehow. And if you have that kind of talent, you turn into Keith Richards or Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
In my case, without a shred of musical talent, I thought about becoming a disc jockey.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
I made that decision one night I was actually in San Diego by that point, but I was still listening to KFWB in Los Angeles. And my favorite guy there was a guy named Bill Balance.
Mm.
And he's on there one night and I'm listening and he says, well, I'm off the air in 20 minutes, going to hop into my brand new convertible sports car, pick up my new starlet girlfriend. She's under contract to Warner Brothers and we are going to cruise the strip. And I lay there in my little bed and I thought, my God, that's the life I would like to lead.
Oh, man.
And I didn't even know what the strip was or how to cruise it. But I thought, when the time comes, I will find out. And the next morning at breakfast, I brightly announced, I've discovered my life's calling. Oh, good. What is it? I'm going to be a disc jockey. Well, you can imagine how that went over.
Yeah, right.
The old Woody Allen line, my father threw a rope over the beam and my mother put her head in the oven. You know, they were not thrilled. But that was the beginning.
I had a similar response to my declaration of wanting to become an actor, and my parents were like, that's not an option. You're either going to be a preacher or a teacher, and that's that.
Well, you can't blame them. I mean, no. it's a chancy job at best.
How did you make that transition from having your parents' reaction? How did you spend your time? What did you do?
Well, I did what at the time I thought was absolutely asinine, but I did it anyway. I got a hold of some old record players and a little tape recorder I found at a thrift shop, and I put a little radio studio together in the garage, and I sat out there and I practiced being a disc jockey. And then I was incredibly lucky. I managed to meet a real radio guy, and thank goodness he was a wonderful, warm human being, and he kind of took me under his wing, and he gave me a lot of good advice. And the advice that he gave me that was valid then, it wouldn't be valid today necessarily, but he said, forget about trying to be funny or any of that crap. They're not going to want you to do that in these first jobs. What they're going to want to know is, can he read a 5-minute newscast without sounding like an idiot and stumbling all over everything? Can he read a 60-second commercial without butchering it so bad the sponsor cancels? Hmm. So he said, my advice to you is practice reading aloud. So that's mostly what I did. I would read the news out of the newspaper and commercials out of magazines.
I think that's one of the things that always impress me about folks, like even driving over here listening to Don McKinnon read these chunks of copy. Mm-hmm. I think the piece I heard was him doing a Wonder Bread ad.
There used to be a lot of live copy, and it was wonderful. It allowed a disc jockey to get his personality across in the middle of doing a commercial for a sponsor. Sometimes you'd get into trouble. But, I mean, people who perhaps remember the real Don Steele on KHJ, he would do these silly commercials for Save-On.
Uh-huh.
And I swear to God, he wouldn't change a word of the copy, but by inflection and pausing, he made it sound absolutely obscene and very, very funny. But if you were the sponsor, you go, well, he read every word I wrote, you know.
And he's getting an emotional reaction on my copy that otherwise might just have sat there like another ad.
Who knows how, you know, but he wouldn't get into trouble because he could honestly say, didn't change a word of it, fellas.
Yeah.
Just happened to pause here before I said that, but,
right.
You know, I'm only human. I have to take a pause. But what happened was, unfortunately, at a certain point, and I can't, somewhere in the 70s, a new crop of DJs started to come on the horizon. And these were people, for one reason or another, were not good at reading.
Hmm.
And they would stumble over copy. And finally, people said, oh, the hell with it. Pre-record everything. And I said, oh, no. I want my live copy. No, pre-record it. All right. And they took away a huge part of the DJ's arsenal, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, that place, without that, it's literally just segueing into songs and segueing into
that
something
was,
else.
This is, I am, and it's.
Yeah. That's it. Oh, man. Well, it's interesting how that now in the voiceover world, we'll come back to where we were too, but in voiceover, that is also where you get to or try to find places to insert yourself, your personality, your life into that copy, even if you've got, you know, 15 seconds to try to, you know, blast through some, you know, radio spot for Toyota.
Well, that's what I, part of what I cover in Vocal Recall, A Life in Radio and Voiceovers. Details on how to obtain the book will be at the conclusion of this broadcast.
As well as a hyperlink in the directly underneath it.
Absolutely. But now I've lost my train of thought. Yes, in radio, the problem was that I learned a lot of bad habits. I was really good at reading aloud. I would not make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But I developed what the late, great Dawes Butler referred to as the cosmetic read. And you still hear it on the air. They still do a bit of live copy here and there. And it's basically a radio announcer. And he says, this is a really good product. You need to get this. Get some today. It's good. And boy, slicks, professional, just perfect, except zero believability because he sounds like an announcer. And the people who cast radio and television commercials, that is the last thing in the world that they want.
Yeah.
I'll clean it up for you because this is a family podcast. But the first agent that I ever played my demo for listened to about 35 seconds, snapped it off, stood up, glared at me, and said, "You sound like a blankety-blank radio announcer." And I'm sitting in my chair going, "I am a radio announcer. What's your point?"
Yeah.
And then he tried to explain it to me, and it took me a long time to get it. But basically, they don't want that. What they want is, to a greater or lesser degree, something that sounds like a real human being imparting knowledge to a trusted friend or loved one with absolute total sincerity. At least they did back then.
Yeah.
And it becomes a little bit of an acting chore, which is something I had never studied.
Hmm.
Eventually I came to say to regard these commercials as monologues. It's like a monologue in a play.
Yeah.
And I was once in an acting class, and a guy did a monologue, and he wasn't very good. And the teacher said, "Did you happen to actually read the whole play that this Well, no. Well, don't you think you should read the play so you could understand why the character is saying what he's... Well, I guess so, you know. Yeah, well, why don't you go do that and then come back and try again? I realized here we have monologues, but there's no play I can read.
Yeah.
So I have to create a play, at least the front part of the play leading up to the monologue.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, a really skilled actor can do Hamlet's to be or not to be if through some insane combination of events he never read Hamlet.
Right.
You know, well, look, he's conflicted, and you don't need to. He's just,
right.
he's contemplating suicide. Just go for it.
It's all there in the beginning, isn't it? To be or not be.
Yeah.
What more do I need?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But so I began to approach copy. I would try to invent a front story that led to this monologue. And it didn't always work. What you have to do, I attended a marvelous workshop. Run by Maurice Tobias, who
you
may have heard of. And I hope she won't be angry with me for giving away one of her techniques. But she had us do something we had written and then a piece of copy somebody else had written.
Hmm.
And it was so obvious right from the get-go. People were so much better with what they had written. Because, of course, they wrote it. It's their thoughts.
Yeah.
Nobody needs to teach you how to speak to another human being. You automatically know which words to emphasize because you're conveying your own thoughts. But somebody writes something down and suddenly it is,
"Have you ever thought about how much fun it would be to go to Disneyland?"
You know, as opposed to you're talking to your five-year-old. "Have you ever thought how much fun it would be to go to Disneyland? Sweetie, you want to go?" Nobody has to teach you how to do that, but somehow when somebody else wrote it and it's on a printed page, suddenly,
right.
And that's the huge hurdle you have to get over, and it is. It sounds simple, but it's a massive hurdle, and it. Some people lock into it like the other people. I'm still struggling.
Hmm.
I still read stuff and I go, "That doesn't sound like I meant that." It just sounds like I'm reading it. Uh-huh. And then, of course, you're confronted with retail copy that, my God, Laurence Olivier couldn't make it sound real.
They don't give you anything to connect to, nothing emotional, nothing that you can find your... You know.
I remember the acting class where the teacher said, "When you're in the wings waiting to make your entrance, all you should be thinking about in your mind is, what did your character do today? Did you get here on the subway? How was that? Was there some drunk misbehaving? What was the subway ride like? Did the air conditioning break down?" There's this whole thing so that when you walk on stage, you're not Neil Ross the actor. You are the character.
Right. And you're not sitting there clinging to that, "What's that first line? My first line, the first thing I got to say." And then it just sounds like your first line rather than that continuation.
Another great idea I got from Brian Cummings. He invents a line or two leading into the spot. And, of course, if you can record your own auditions, then you can actually – he would do it in his mind. But if you're recording your own auditions, you could actually do it and then snip it out.
Oh, that's so great.
You know?
I like – Pat Fraley told us a stolen bit –
Now, Pat's another great I love Pat. I've worked with him for years. He's a great teacher. But yeah. Please, go ahead.
But, well, he said there's a story of John Cleese in the booth. And they're like, handed him a piece of copy, and he's in there, and they hear. Mm-hmm. They're like, Mr. Cleese, are you ready? One moment, let me finish writing my ad-libs. And like I love that idea too. I mean, I come from an improv background, but I also improvise as a writer for myself before leading in those moments, just to be able to. There's no premium on coming up with it in the moment. The premium is in the creativity of the possibility versus the immediacy of the thought. You know, I don't know. It was interesting. In your book, you talk about, you know, listening to Gene Shepherd and him being one of your favorite people to listen to in New York, and what you describe in particular about both how he and Stern too now being someone who is a contemporary in that way of really having that conversation, that bringing that sort of connection to commercial copy in a way that those guys were able to connect in their monologues as jocks, I guess, in a way, or as radio folks.
Yeah, I don't know if Gene Shepherd ever spun records. We should probably explain who Gene Shepherd was. It's been a long time. He started out in radio, as far as I know. Then he began to write, published a couple of books, used to read stuff by him in Playboy magazine, which I always read for the fiction alone.
Yes.
And then he did a screenplay that they made into a movie. Now I'm spacing the title.
A Christmas Story.
A Christmas Story. And he was the narrator in The Christmas Story. But I heard him on WOR in New York. He was only on for 45 minutes. They did a 15-minute newscast at 11 o'clock at night. He came on at 11:15. His theme song would trickle in, and he would sort of, it was almost like he was in mid-sentence. There was none of this, hey, how's everybody doing tonight? It's your old pal Gene Shepherd. It would just be, so I'm walking up Broadway, and I see an Upper West Side bum. Now, Upper West Side bums are different from bums you find in other parts of the city, and off he goes. And he would go on four or five tangents. So where the hell is he going with this? And somehow, at the end of 45 minutes, he'd pull all those different strands together into a finished punchline, and the theme would trickle in, and he was gone.
Oh,
and I would sit there in utter amazement. There was never a fumfer, never a pause. He never searched for words. And yet it did not sound like he was reading it. Now, for all I know, it was all written out ahead of time, but it didn't sound like it.
Mm.
And some of the stories he would talk about his boyhood in Indiana and his dealings with his father. You know, my old man, now he gets wind of this. Now I'm in trouble. And in my book, I mention when I hear Stern do riffs on his dealings with his parents, I hear echoes of Gene Shepherd. Mm. I'm sure I don't know what the hell Shepherd would have thought of Howard Stern. But there is a sort of a common thread of authenticity to what both of them are doing.
That's true.
And Shepherd was once you started to listen, you couldn't tune out.
Yeah.
You just could not tune out. What's he going to do next?
How has his... How did that affect you? Like the guys that you listened to who were influences, like Bill when you first started, Don, like just the people who were colleagues, how did that affect you both as a DJ and then down the road as you transition into more animation work?
Well, as far as disc jockey, I made the mistake that a lot of beginners do. I tried to be something I wasn't prepared to be. If I had it to do all over again, I would do a very straight I was or that was, this is, I am, and it's for about the first 4 years and then gradually try to build on that. But I tried to jump in and be Bill Balance right from the get-go. I tried to be Don McKinnon. I should explain who Don McKinnon was because I suspect not many people know. But he was a brilliantly funny, innovative top 40 disc jockey. I heard Don Imus once say he was the greatest disc jockey who ever lived. I don't know that I'd argue with that. He was fantastically funny and creative and tragically died in a car accident on the road to Malibu at the age of 31. But he had a profound influence on me, and I would try to be Don, and I would fail miserably. Eventually, I learned, you know what? Quit trying to be all these other guys and just be whatever the hell you are. And that eventually worked out for me.
That's a hard thing to kind of, I don't know, especially as a mimic for me growing up. I always felt like, you know, my influences were, you know, first album that I bought was Robin Williams, the Throbbing Python of Love, a stand-up set he did at a club in San Francisco, and memorized it and did it and ran it, and was thought that if I did that, you know, like my Rich Little analogy, if I can do that, it's a shortcut. But there ain't no shortcuts, you know what I mean?
No.
And it's finding who you are and embracing the fullness of that, right?
I think it's the path that most people follow. They start out trying to emulate what they think is great. And eventually they realize I'm getting nowhere being a Xerox copy of my hero. I have to find my own way, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And sometimes you stumble into it. I don't know how true it is, but I read that Lewis Black was doing a fairly standard stand-up routine and was moderately successful. And one night backstage, he got angry about something, and in a comedic way, just backstage yelling at a couple of his fellow comedians, "Why they got to do? And you know what else?" And somebody said, "You know what, you dumb SOB? That's
your act.
What you need to do on stage."
Yeah.
Really? Yes. You know.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And it's the business of show is endlessly fascinating, endlessly frustrating, but ultimately, I think, endlessly rewarding. For some reason, actors, it's such a joy to be somebody else. That sounds. Are we that miserable in our own skin? I don't know, but somehow there's a great joy in being somebody else.
Yeah.
And like Dana Carvey, you'll do it around the house just for your own amusement.
Oh, man. Yeah. I'm so grateful for the car. Like the amount of time. Like,
especially now that there's cell phones. You got a cell phone on the dash.
Yeah.
Somebody looks at you and you're talking to yourself. You go, "No, I'm on the phone.
I'm on the phone. It's all good."
The other thing is, 20 years ago, if you were driving around L.A., and you saw a guy pacing back and forth on the sidewalk, screaming at the heavens, you would say, "Well, it's either a lunatic or an actor preparing to audition." But now it could be, I was at the 3rd Street Promenade not long ago, and I said, "Oh, boy, alert, alert, alert." And I'm looking around, and I see the source of the screaming. It's a guy immaculately dressed and coiffed, and I realize he's got one of those little earbuds, and he's screaming at somebody over the phone.
Oh,
but
man.
I thought, uh-oh.
Yeah, know. someone snapped.
It's and I love being in an elevator and someone's on the phone and you don't realize, and they go, "So how you been?" And I go, I've been good. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Didn't mean to third party your conversation with your... So, well, how did you make the transition from, you know, radio... and the voice of into going into the animation world?
Okay, well, as I told you, I had already been fooling around with character voices, but I really didn't have much of an outlet for that on radio. I tried to create characters and interact with them on the air, but the radio had changed. People really didn't want that. I was discouraged from doing that. And then I did a radio serial with a buddy of mine down in San Diego, about 75 episodes, and I basically played the entire supporting cast, and it was really fun. And I started thinking I would watch cartoons on Saturday mornings, and one second I'd say, I'm just as good as those guys. And then 2 seconds later, oh, there's no way they'd throw me out of my ear.
Yeah, right.
But, and around that same time, I discovered that voiceover existed. It was a very well-kept secret back in the day. And this record promoter just happened to mention that a guy named Danny Dark, who had been a disc jockey, was no longer a disc jockey, but had become quite wealthy. And I said, "How did he become wealthy? Did he marry somebody?" And this guy said, "No, he made the money in voiceover." I said, "He made the money in what?" "Voiceover." "What is that?" I said, scarcely daring to dream, and there should have been a celestial chorus playing above my head. He said, "You know, commercials, cartoons, promos, voiceover." I said, you can make a living doing that?" He said, "Make a living? Danny Dark, you know." Now off he goes talking about how much money Danny Dark has.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had been aware of these people I heard doing national television commercials, national radio commercials, narrating things. And I had just naively assumed, well, they're all just actors moonlighting, which I'm sure they were in some cases. But it had never occurred to me that voiceover was a business unto itself.
Hmm.
And the minute I found out about that, I said, that's what I need to be doing, because I'm using maybe 40% of what I got in radio. I could put 100% into this voiceover game. And it took me about 10 years to get it going, but I gradually made the transition. And how did I
stop sounding like an announcer and turn into a relative human being?
Yeah.
That was just a lot of work and workshops and teachers. And it took quite a few years. As I say, I'm still working on it. There are some people I hear and it's just effortless and I can't quite get there, but I'm doing my best.
I mean, you've done such... You know, as a character actor, it's one of the kind of the great things that this particular life affords us, the ability to tap into that love that starts so early in us, and that there's something that's super innate to it, you know, of like, eight different guys, okay, no problem. A couple different trucks who turns into robots, I can figure that out, you know? But like... I don't know. There's something interesting about that the distance. I'm teaching a class over at Second City, like an intro class, and we started with doing animation and then working towards commercial. And the point of that was kind of to, as you get into commercial work, you seem to get closer and closer to who you are. And it's kind of like the movie The Professional, where it's easier to kill with a sniper rifle than it is with a knife.
I remember Jack Angel, who I'm sure you've heard of, saying the most frightening direction he ever got in his life was be yourself.
Hmm.
Because, as I said, actors take great joy in being somebody else.
Yeah.
Somehow, when you do spokesperson work, you've got to be you, or at least some part of you.
Yeah.
It's a tricky thing. And the closer you get to you, the harder it becomes to do it somehow.
Yeah.
Isn't that strange?
I agree.
Only a Freudian psychologist could explain the problems that we have here. This career we have chosen. Because we are sick.
I think that must be it.
I don't know.
I mean, for me, like, I think the world of cartoon stuff. I mean, it's all Freudian. But like, you know, I mean, for me,
some of the ones they're doing now, yes.
Oh yeah, yeah, right.
Beyond Freud. Freud would go, I can't deal with this.
I cannot understand. It's so interesting to you know, those things that spark you as a child, and then to come back around to it in a. When you're older, like sometimes 20, 30, 40 years later, and to be standing in that space going, you know, this is something I've dreamed of doing, and then you've done it. You know, you might have had this goal for yourself, and once you've achieved your goal, what do you do next? And how do you, you know, life doesn't end when you've done that gig.
Yeah.
So
I did a podcast recently with a woman. It was all about radio. She's a radio person, and she's... suddenly said, the tragedy in our business for so many is they peak so young.
Hmm.
And I remember a story about the late, great Robert W. Morgan, who was the morning guy on KHJ in the 60s. I don't know if it's true or not. I didn't witness it, but I don't think he would mind. He's gone now.
Hmm.
But there's a story that the ratings came out, and for the first time, he was number one in Los Angeles in the morning. Beat everybody. He was number one. And they're in the lobby congratulating him, and he turned to someone and quietly said, I'm 29 years old, and I have just achieved my life's ambition. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
And he spent the rest of his life trying to answer that question. I was very lucky. I never even got within a you know, spitting distance of anything approaching success till I was almost 40. So I felt that was almost a little too late. I remember I just read something about Rodney Dangerfield. He was so mad that it took him so long to make it. He said, you know, he said, all those years I wasted, you know, it's not fair. You know, I should get to live to at least be 120.
Yeah, right.
So I could enjoy, you know, the kind of career that other people have had.
Exactly.
But no, it actually was perfect timing for me because I was just old enough to be halfway sensible with the success and and not do something stupid.
Oh, man. I agree. Yeah. I agree. It comes when it comes to you. And
but when it comes too soon, it's dangerous, I think.
I agree.
I've known people who made it, you know, in their early 20s, and somehow it always has a sad ending.
Yeah.
You're just not prepared for it. It comes too easy. You don't value it. By God, when I broke through at the age of 38, 39, I knew what I had, and I was not about to screw it up.
Yeah.
For love or money.
Yeah. That's so true, and it's fascinating. I, you know, working with the Second City, you know, you see people like just meteoric rise, right out of college, and hit these heights that become what people assume is the trajectory you're supposed to hit, and for whatever reason, the bits that they wrote have been celebrated and they're whisked off, and it can lead to savage disillusionment and frustration.
Yep.
And
there was an English actor named Dirk Bogarde, and he wrote a couple of books and they were very good, and they were autobiographical. And in one of them, he said he was the only one in his family who got into show business. The rest of them, it was a great mystery to all of them. And finally, his sister said to him once, "I think I get it now." She said, "In any other line of work, you just progress up the ladder, one rung at a time, and to a certain level." She said, "But your business is snakes and ladders, isn't it?"
Huh.
If you remember that, I think they call it chutes and ladders.
Chutes and ladders
in the States. In England, it's snakes and ladders. But basically, you're two moves away from winning the game, and then all the way back down to the bottom, and you got to start over again.
Right.
And that really is, to a great extent, show business. The actor Robert Forster, who I think is marvelous, I mean, he was completely wiped out. He got back in the business because he was having coffee where there was a young guy who I think was a script writer or something
Tarantino.
And recognized him and said, "Boy, what are you doing?" "Well, nothing." "Why? How can you be doing nothing?" "Well, I'm doing nothing." "Well, maybe we can do something about that." And boom, he's back in the game again.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Yeah.
Again, I have been fantastically lucky in that I never really had a real down period. Somehow when cartoons dried up, suddenly I was doing narrations. When narrations dried up, suddenly I was doing commercials. You know, some years were better than others, but
sure.
I really avoided the really big crash that happens to some people.
Was that an active awareness on your part, or did scripts just start coming for auditions, or were you? I mean, you. One of the things that really resonated in your book was how hard you work, how much more time you put in. Like when you were in your early days at the radio station, where it was like, no one else wants to do programming. I'll figure this out. Let me go in the room and start cutting and mixing and doing the stuff that other people don't want to do. And that contributed to, currently contributes to your longevity and ability to continue on.
Yeah. One of the things I discovered when I got into radio was there are two studios in every station. One is the air studio where the disc jockey works. The other is called the production room or the production studio. That's where they put the commercials together. And a lot of it is really grunt work. You know, commercials come in from the agencies. In the old days, it was on reel-to-reel tape or acetate disc, and you had to dub it, copy it across onto a cartridge.
Okay.
To play on the air, and then you had to type out a label and put it on the cartridge and take it in. I mean, it's just grunt work, and nobody wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And even recording a commercial, they didn't want to do that. Frequently, I was the only one in the station who seemed to actually enjoy being in the production studio. which was sort of a pre-echo of voiceovers, because what appealed to me about the production studio was you got do-overs.
Yeah.
When you're live on the air, you either blow it or you don't. But in the production studio, you can do it over and over and over again until you get it as good as you possibly can. And then you put it in the room, and it might play on the radio 100 times. It plays over and over. It's not, you know, disc jockeys are writing on water, essentially. Yeah, it's, you know, you say it's gone.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody says, hey, you said a funny thing a year ago, something about a dog. I don't remember, but I laughed, you know.
Right.
That's what disc jockeys hear if they hear anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved, and somehow that production work led me to focus on these people that I was hearing who were doing the national stuff, wondering, why do they sound so much better than I do?
Hmm.
Do they have better microphones? Well, they probably did, but it had a lot more, a lot less to do with microphones, a lot more to do with the fact that these people were really talented, experienced, knew what they were doing, you know, and I was some local yokel.
Well, you know, you it's like you were saying, you know, you start based on what you hear,
mm-hmm.
and using, you know, doing impressions, doing voices, building up this sort of repertoire of fun, original characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, all right, kid, congratulations. Your dreams are come true. Now, here's the reality. Your dreams start mopping.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, I'm in. But now I got to figure out how to rise inside of that. You know, I feel that way at every, you know, every time you get to a whatever, like you level up or something, it happens in that way.
I think the reason that I really avoided major career lows was I have a pretty good work ethic. And so if I'm not working, I'm practicing, or I'm not real good at promotion, but I am practicing. And the other thing is my agents, CESD. I would be nowhere without those people. They are, I say the two things that I'm really grateful for are my agents and the union, SAG-AFTRA.
Yeah.
SAG-AFTRA setting the minimums and the agents providing the opportunities to get the work. I mean, if I can't make something out of that, I don't belong here. And everybody at CESD, present and past, has just been marvelous. It's a great agency. I really have no experience of any others except my first agent, Donnelly Davies, who came to CESD, brought me with her. And I'm like the guy who married his high school sweetheart. I don't know what I missed or didn't miss. You know?
That's so great.
This is what I know.
And that combination of knowing what you've got and honoring it by putting in that hard work to meet the opportunities that come to you, regardless of whether it's coming from Pat or Kathy or Bo or Samir or Vinny, like knowing that if I'm going to get a, you know, what am I able to, how can I stay sharp when things are transitioning?
Well, there's something that I quote Robert Evans in my book from his marvelous book, which I highly recommend, The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Yeah.
And his definition of luck is when opportunity meets preparation.
Hmm.
And there's, you know, a million people running around L.A. waiting for that break, but are they preparing for it? Are they preparing for that opportunity? Because, God, there's nothing more tragic than being given an opportunity and not being prepared for it.
Yeah.
Because it may not come again.
It may not.
Yeah.
I think if there was one regret, I've been in town for 9 years, I think, and when I first got to town, they were doing casting director workshops, and I was like, well, I'm here. It's time to go. And then I went in front of as many casting directors as I could, as unprepared as I was. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was prepared, but I didn't really have an awareness of what that really meant until it was like, fall back and figure, really work your craft before you start showing your wares. You know?
It's so hard to make the transition. I came here, well, I was a year in San Francisco, but basically came here from San Diego. And I had worked in Honolulu and San Diego, and I was one of the two guys in town who could do voices. Mm-hmm. So every Halloween, I was going to either be Boris Karloff or Dracula.
Yeah,
you know,
Bela Lugosi.
Thank you very much. So I get to L.A., and Bob Lloyd at the voice caster holds an audition. He's looking for Boris Karloff. Well, I'm going to nail this one because I'm the guy. Get there, and there's a lobby full of guys who could have called Boris's mother and fooled her. Man. And you suddenly realize, oh, there's nothing in this town but the best of the best.
That's right.
And I got to somehow beat these guys. How in the hell am I going to do that? And that's there begins the quest.
How do you do that? How do you...
Practice. It's like the old joke. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Yeah. Practice, my boy. Practice.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And hope that, well, you know, that you're the... What is it? I mean, you got 25 Boris Karloffs in the room, and every different Boris Karloff is a different flavor of it. There's a grape Boris Karloff and a chocolate one. Yeah. And one that sort of smells like orchids, and maybe that's the one that books, but maybe, making sure that maybe. Your Boris Karloff is 100% is just the Neil Ross one that makes that closes the deal.
It's just very daunting when you suddenly realize, oh man, here I am at ground zero. This really is the big time.
Yeah, no doubt.
I mentioned in the book what it felt like the first few times I got booked at Hanna-Barbera. And I would walk in, and there would be Lenny Weinrib and Joni Gerber and Michael Bell. Mm. I was like a kid who got a part in a Warner Brothers, you know, a walk-on in a Warner Brothers movie, and I'm suddenly on the set with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh. Yeah. And it's like, wow, because these people, to me, were just absolutely legendary.
What was that experience like to be able to... Not just be there, but like they're your castmates. What is that experience like after coming from a place where you're working by yourself so much, you know, in radio and making that transition?
Well, I think part of the reason radio appealed to me is I am an introverted extrovert.
I like that expression.
I like to perform, but I like to do it in private. And there were actually quite a few radio people I knew who were like that. There was one guy, you'd listen to him on the air, he sounded like the wildest, craziest, most over-the-top guy in the world.
Yeah.
If the janitor came in to empty the trash can and he had to open the mic, he couldn't work until that guy left the room. I did news for him, and he'd get on a roll, and I'd kind of grin at him through the window like, hey, and he'd see me, and he'd immediately freeze and have to roll a record and kill the mic. I learned to not look at him.
Wow.
It was fascinating. But anyway, after years of living, now I'm approaching middle age, and I get in these situations, and I suddenly realize, hey, I've kind of grown a little bit. I like working with other people. This is fun. Wow. And the big kids would kid around, and I'm here to do six lines, and I don't want to screw them up. I'll just let them do the shtick. I'll just behave myself. Later, I started to do shtick far too much, I'm afraid, in some cases. But I began to realize, oh, this is really fun working with other people. Oh, what I've been missing. And then I'd have to go back down to the radio station, sit alone in a room waiting for Elton John to finish, you know. It was like I'd been sent to my room, you know. When can I get out of here and play with the kids again up in Cahuenga Pass?
Up in the fun house.
Yeah.
I have to go back to my room. That's an interesting thing. How do you find that sense of when to allow yourself to relax and be and do bits and kind of know your space when you're a recurring guest or when you're a co-star for a couple lines? Like having a sense of that balance.
Well, it all comes down, I think, to taste and judgment. You know, there are people who are absolutely brilliant at studio shtick.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't try to emulate them because maybe you don't have their chops. There's one guy, I won't say who it is, but he, when the director gets on the button to give direction, And you have to understand, when the button is pushed, now the director's speakers are cut off. They can't hear the actors.
Oh, wow.
And they got their head down on the storyboard. Now, what I need here is this and that. Well, the whole time they're talking, he's going, what do you know? Who are you to tell me how to do this? Honestly, I'm not going to put up with this. And somehow he has a sixth sense. A nanosecond before they take their finger off the button, he stops. And they don't have a clue that he's doing this. And I've seen other actors go, oh, that looks like fun. And they try to do it, and they don't have his timing. And it's, what did you just say to me? Oh, no, I'm sorry. I, you know.
Just doing a bit.
And then there are some actors who like to be left alone and concentrate, and I respect that.
Yeah.
And so if I'm looking around and, two people are laughing and three people are sort of frowning, like, would you shut up? I'm trying to work here.
Yeah.
I'll back off. You just kind of have to feel your way.
Yeah.
But I have heard some of the funniest lines in my life uttered at cartoon sessions.
Oh, man.
Some of these sessions, it's like the greatest party you ever went to. They're just not serving any alcohol.
Yeah, right.
But other than that, and occasionally they interrupt you, making you work, which is annoying.
Yeah, right. Can we stop screwing around for a second? Oh, man. I mean, get a little bit of that in the lobby over at CESD waiting for an audition when it's a big all hands on deck and everybody's catching up, and it's like going to a... It's like going to your high school reunion.
Yeah.
It's so fun to hang out in that. And you forget, as solitary as this work can be, how much fun the other people that you get to work alongside are.
I know. I always tried to get my wife to come to various events. And she had some traumatic experience with showbiz types when she was younger. And she's, no, you go. I'll just... But we had we worked the Long Beach Convention, about half a dozen of us who had been in G.I. Joe.
Oh, yeah.
And my place is fairly close to that. So I invited everybody up. Well, they all came, and most of them stayed long into the evening.
Yeah.
And the next morning, my wife said, that was so much fun. She said, I haven't had fun like that in years. How am I going to go back to my normal life? I said, I don't know. That's your problem.
That's
I said, this is what I have been trying to tell you. These people are fun to be around.
Yeah.
There's just a level of mental acuity that just pops.
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
My wife does a lot of theater, and I remember the last time she did a production down at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. And we went down there, and we had been driving across country. It took us 4 days to get there. It was great. Left the car with her, and my daughter flew back. But we got there and went backstage, and it was first day of rehearsal and had that energy. Mm-hmm. And there was a bunch of friends of hers from New York who were down getting ready to do the show. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly that energy of just this being surrounded and then among them. Not as an outsider, as an audience member, but being embraced and connected to and just being part of something. Even though we weren't working, it just reminds you how robust and charming and fun and why you do it in the first place to be alongside these folks.
Yeah, and generally speaking, performers are fascinating folks to be around. Not all of them, some people... are rather colorless and still do a wonderful job. And I don't insist that you entertain me when I work with you, but, you get the right combination of actors riffing off each other, and it's just it's a lot of fun.
It really is.
Yeah.
How do you make the transition into, I don't know necessarily about transitions, I think these things overlap, but like with narration, like doing Nova, as many episodes as you've done and that kind of stuff. What's that experience been like?
Well, it's one of the things I always wanted to do, harkening back to the days when I was in high school, and for a semester or so, I was the AV guy, sitting in a room with a cart just like that TV is sitting on over there. Only would have a movie projector on it. If a teacher wanted to show a movie, you'd push the card into the thing and you'd thread it up and play the movie. But for a lot of the time, nobody was scheduling movies, so I was supposed to be sitting there doing my homework. But instead, I'd put on documentaries that they had in the library, and I began to focus on this one narrator.
Uh-huh.
He was marvelous. You could close your eyes. You didn't need a picture.
Oh, wow.
And his name was Alexander Scorby.
Uh-huh.
And I was so enamored of his work, and I remember thinking all the way back to the 11th grade at Point Loma High in San Diego, God, I wonder if I could ever do something like that. And eventually, after many years of your benefits as an employee of Foodman Industries kind of stuff,
yeah,
I finally got to do some Novas, and I did a show called Movie Magic about movie special effects.
Oh, man.
That ran on the Discovery Channel. And
oh, I remember that show. I didn't realize you had narrated that. So great.
Yeah. And I enjoy narration very much. I to me, it harkens all the way back to the... one of the elders standing up around the campfire and telling his tribe the legends of their people.
Yeah.
It's storytelling, which I think goes all the way back to primitive man.
Yeah.
Maybe the oldest VO gig in the world.
That's right.
They're staring at the fire. They're not looking at him. And he's telling them, this is how we came. This is why we're here. This is our destiny. And... so, yeah, narration, I always wanted to do it, and I was very lucky I actually got to do some pretty good narration work.
That's so cool.
Pretty good, I mean the shows I worked on, not me necessarily.
I understand. It's been fascinating to discover kind of the differences between narrating an audiobook, for example, and then narrating a television program, and the kind of... you know, just the subtle nuances between different types of performance too. Even something as subtle as the difference between animation and video games. There's a level of awareness of who your audience is, and those kind of sort of adjustments that you need to make based on the form that you're engaged in.
I've never done an audiobook other than my book. I don't know how I would be at that. It's a lot of work, based on recording my book. My hat's off to people who do it.
Did you have a director? Or did you self-record?
No. Well, I sort of did. I did one pass at it and sent it to a friend of mine, and he made some very perceptive comments, and I went back and did it again. So I guess he was the director.
That's cool. I recommend it. I think if it's something that you want to do. In particular, I've done it both ways. I've done the ACX style, which is the Audible Amazon Creation Exchange or Audible. It's the audiobook creation exchange, I'm sorry. But it either goes specifically for Audible or Amazon exclusively gets the distribution. But you end up cutting the whole thing yourself. And that volume of work was intense. And going to a studio and doing a book over the course of 4 or 5 days is really enjoyable. And
I would think you'd need a lot of stamina, though.
You know, if you work with a good director who is really listening and can tell when you need a break, it's surprising. I think the longest book I've done was at 25 finished hours about the rise of conservatism and Barry Goldwater's campaign. So it was... and it's a terrific book, but it's very much written to be read, not necessarily read aloud. So I found myself having to go back and figure out where my breaths were going to be.
Sure.
But I think you'd have a great time, especially if it's a topic that you're engaged in.
Mm-hmm.
It's really satisfying.
Well, perhaps that will happen. The game's not over yet.
Amen. Amen. What? Just checking on time. Our time is, as we predicted, running.
Our time has flown.
Just about. I wanted to talk with you about your experience doing Live Announced during the Emmys and the Oscars, what that experience was like as well.
Oh, well, yeah. The Oscars. And that was the first live event I ever did. It's like I started at the top. And
Right. You peaked early. You were 29 at your call.
I was only 59 and I peaked. But it was, I realized as soon as I got in there, it's a kind of a different animal. The guy who directed it and had a hand in choosing me to do it. And I was not alone. I worked with Randy Thomas that year. We were co-announcers. Yes, she is. And he said, you've got a live radio background. That's good. You're used to being on live. That'll help. And I sort of dismissed that. But then I realized, yes, of course, most of my brethren who did not come out of radio, they're used to breezing into a place like this. And yeah. Oh, I should be able to knock this sucker out in about 10 takes. You know, when you're live event, you got one take each time, and yeah. That's it. And I would imagine that would be daunting to someone who has never been on live. As far as being a disc jockey on live, yes, you're used to that, but you have control. If you get into trouble, you can quickly roll a record and go, now, where the hell am I? Did I play this or that? But in this situation, you're live, but you have no control over when you go on. You have to take a cue from the truck. Uh-huh. And sometimes that's difficult because what you're hearing in the headphones is a truck full of guys going, did you cue that tape up? Where's that thing? Give me camera 9. What are you doing? And somewhere in all of that is a guy going, stand by, announce. Announce, go. And announce, go, you got to start talking. And if you go too soon, that's a hideous no-no. And if you miss a cue, that's a hideous no-no. And you're... There's and you got to pronounce everybody's name right. And, yeah. Of course, with the Oscars, there's some pretty strange names once they get into the foreign stuff.
Sure.
And you suddenly begin to realize that there are all these pitfalls and possibilities for you to screw up and make a damn fool out of yourself. Mm-hmm. For a worldwide audience, plus an auditorium full of the cream of Hollywood.
And they're getting your live announce in there because the show is being run from the booth.
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. And... you know, at rehearsal, there are big pieces of cardboard with pictures of the stars placed on the seats where they're going to be so the camera guys can, you know, practice zooming in where they should. And then you say, now, ladies and gentlemen, here to present the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress is Sean Connery. You know, and a guy who looks like Wally Cox comes out and goes,
hi, I'm Sean Connery.
And you go, oh, this is no big deal. And one day they say, well, Sir Sean is here. He's ready to rehearse. And this time when you say Sean Connery, the guy comes out.
Yeah.
And you suddenly realize, oh, God, this is for real, you know.
Yeah.
And in 3 days they'll all be here and we'll be live worldwide. Nothing to worry about there.
That's a thing.
That was probably the most frightened I've ever been in my life was the last... 15 minutes before airtime.
Wow.
You just...
You just kind of have to put your faith in everything and all of your training and experience and preparation.
Well, I did a thing that was, I think, probably negative, but it seemed to work for me. I pictured everyone in my life who had ever sprinkled on my parade, and I put them in bleachers in my mind, and I had them sit there, and I said, now... I am about to do something that none of you SOBs could even think about doing, and I am going to do it flawlessly. Now you sit there and watch. And somehow that calmed me down. I don't know what that says about me as a person, but...
I think that's great. And, I really do. I mean, I think being able to face... Because this business is hard enough as it is to face especially along the rising action and then certainly through every aspect of it, when you have a certain aspiration and people are real quick to tell you that it's not for you, sit down, know your place, to be able to go through that gauntlet and find yourself in a position where you're at that chair, at that microphone, because you've earned it. Mm-hmm. And that's, it's really, really cool. And, you know, I'm blessed to have moments in my career that are like that, too. And there's nothing more satisfying than stepping up to the plate and hitting a solid base hit.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Neil, and reading your book. How can people get a copy or hear your audiobook, or how can people find it?
Well, the simplest thing to do is to get on the interwebs and dial in neilbook.com, neilbook.com.
That's the easiest web address I've ever heard.
Well, I paid a consultant a fortune to come up with that.
Well, perfect.
If you forget that, there's a link at neilross.com, which is my main website, but neilbook.com. It's available in print, Kindle, PDF, and audiobook. Yeah. You can also get to the print and the Kindle directly from Amazon. All you got to do is put in Vocal Recall, Neil Ross, and I'm sure that'll take you to it. And,
I mean, the stories that you tell throughout the book are just so engaging. And for anyone who's interested in learning more about not only the history of our industry, but what it takes to succeed and to stay in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were several things as I was reading it that I just copy and pasted and held on to. And there was mm-hmm. there was a line that one of your now of course I'm blanking on it, but I'll put the link up. But it was about you know, how hard work is the thing that's going to get you through any kind of adversity.
Yeah. Well, I honestly believe that. There's really no shortcut that I'm aware of. You just have to do your homework.
Yeah.
You know? And then when that final exam suddenly pops up out of the blue, you can ace it.
That's it.
If you've done your homework.
And it was just making me think about your story of your FCC exam that you took right after Kennedy was assassinated. Like, you know, that Kennedy's gone, but he hasn't gotten the guy who's in charge of the FCC. So get back to work.
Yeah. That's a really good story. Not that I did a good job of writing it, but it's an amazing story. Yeah, I was studying to get the FCC first class license, and in the middle of all of this, Kennedy is assassinated. And I had just seen Kennedy in the flesh a couple of months before that. And, you know, those of you who were, well, we all were, but if you're young and the first really major catastrophe in your life was 9/11,
yeah.
Kennedy was our 9/11. It was, the feeling was almost the same. You know, when 9/11 happened, I thought, here we go again. This is as bad.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything this bad since Kennedy. And,
man.
But somehow we prevailed.
I prevailed.
Yeah.
Well, how can people find you on the transition out of that? Let's play an up-tempo record.
I'm supposed to do this, and I just did a story about a dead dog.
Does anybody know that reference?
Casey Kasem. Yeah. That's so great. How can people find you on social media? You like on Twitter?
I'm kind of a Luddite. I am available on Facebook.
Okay.
And that's pretty much it.
That's great.
You know, I tried to do Twitter and I couldn't figure it out. You know, they say they want new subscribers and then they create an app that's absolutely incomprehensible. So, you know, good luck to them.
Well, people can find your book and at neilbook.com and at Amazon. And I highly recommend it. It's a terrific read. Neil, it's been wonderful to get to know you. And thank you so much for coming in on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Kiff. I really appreciate it.
Awesome.
Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening. And we'll catch you soon. Peace. This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please go to iTunes and give us a positive rating. It truly helps. Follow me on Twitter at Kiff VH or on Instagram at Kiff VH or on Vero at Kiff VH. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you soon. Claim victory and depart the field.
Werewolf?
There.